From KTOO in Juneau, I'm Jeremy Shea with this news. The advisory committee that the Juneau Assembly put together to flag systemic racism in its legislation has begun making formal recommendations. The committee hasn't flagged anything actionable yet, but there are early signs that the group may be shaping how city policies get made. So far, the committee has officially finished reviews of 11 pieces of legislation.
Thank you, committee. Great work. And here we are, our first month of working as a systemic racism review committee. And that completes our reviews.
That's committee chair Lisa Worrell at the end of its meeting last week. The six-person panel met for the first time back in April. Over the last 6 months, members went through a sort of crash course on what the city and borough of Juneau does and what typical ordinances and resolutions look like. And it wrote a questionnaire for city staffers to help evaluate them. The questionnaire asks things like, who would the legislation impact? What are some unintended consequences? Are there ways to gauge if there is inequality? Now, the committee is reviewing the Assembly's legislation as it comes up. It's mostly been housekeeping measures that have to do with accounting. One exception, the committee reviewed an ordinance to use $24,000 of grant funding to survey and inventory buildings in a particular downtown neighborhood. Planners from the city's community development department who worked on it took committee members' questions. Here's Grace Lee.
How was it that this area that we're talking about was selected?
There's a long thread that eventually leads up to a Juneau Assembly goal to increase the availability of housing in Juneau. So, Lee said,
one thing that would be helpful in a situation like this is to see maybe the breakdown of the races of the homeowners.
There is census data, but that's for residents. There is no easy way to get race data for the property owners who would most directly benefit. Planner Alex Pierce offered the committee one more unknown.
It's hard to know who the beneficiaries will be in the future and how that might change the racial makeup of the neighborhood. We don't have good answers to that, but it's certainly another consideration and another piece of this to muddle through.
Before, staffers and policymaking officials rarely discussed race and equity. Now, the Systemic Racism Review Committee forces city staffers to think about and discuss race and equity before the Juneau Assembly votes on something. Lisa Worrell said the limited information gives her some concern and anxiousness.
I would like to have a lot more data available, so hopefully that's something we will continue to build on. As we continue to work through, these are areas I can see that may be a challenge, not just for this particular ordinance, but for many.
The committee gave the ordinance a thumbs up. It also sent the Assembly a recommendation to gather more race data about neighborhoods affected by legislation in the future. In local COVID-19 news, Juneau officials announced plans to host free pediatric vaccine clinics the week of November 8th, pending federal approval for children ages 5 to 11. The city expects to have about 1,200 doses of the Pfizer vaccine for these children. Clinics will be held at Juneau schools. Specifics are not set yet, but registration may open as early as November 2nd. The Alaska Department of Health and Social Services identified 44 Juneau residents and one non-resident with new cases from Saturday through Monday. The total active case count is down since Friday to 148. Four people are at Bartlett Regional Hospital with COVID-19. In Juneau schools, there were three new cases, one at Juneau Community Charter School that did not affect classes, and two at Juneau Douglas High School, Yada Atzkahle. The two high school cases were related to extracurricular activities. The state also reported five new deaths and 1,686 new cases through the weekend. The deaths were among residents in Anchorage, Kodiak, and Wasilla. Fairbanks Memorial Hospital has set up a mobile morgue in the parking lot to prepare for any mass casualty event. As KUAC's Robin reports, the refrigerated container is not running yet, but can be ready in 2 hours.
Foundation Health Partners used federal COVID grant money to buy a mobile refrigeration unit. It's been sitting ready in the south lot of Fairbanks Memorial Hospital since last December.
When we saw the surge with the Delta variant, we decided it was time to exercise that surge morgue capacity and make sure that if we needed it, we had moved it in place. We were able to power it appropriately and just make sure that the teams knew how to use it if we ever needed it.
Keith Fair, Director of Emergency Management for Foundation Health Partners, says it's a refrigerated Connex container. It looks like a standard storage container. He says the hospital moved it close to the building to get ahead of the snow.
We moved it in September into place and put a portable generator on it to make sure that it would work, and did a systems check on it and spent time training our team so that they knew how to stand it up in a very short amount of time if it was necessary.
So far, it hasn't been necessary. The FMH morgue can hold 4 bodies and hasn't needed more capacity.
To my knowledge, the morgue capacity has never been overwhelmed at the hospital. We have a great relationship with our mortuary partners, and they come in and move the bodies out of the morgue and have been very timely about that.
The surge morgue can be fully functional within 2 hours and can hold 6 to 8 bodies.
Currently, we've got stretchers in place inside so that the bodies are treated appropriately. But with new grant funding that's coming, we'll be purchasing some racking that will allow us to appropriately treat up to 16 in that space.
Fear says the extra morgue capacity has been on a to-do list since a regulatory agency suggested it for the hospital in 2008. Regional hospitals are supposed to be prepared for mass casualty events like a chemical leak or a plane crash. And Fear says because it's a federal asset, it can be shared with local emergency services at the site of an accident to quickly help with appropriate care. In Fairbanks, I'm Robin.
Alaska cold case investigators say they have named another woman murdered by the state's most notorious serial killer after nearly 4 decades of mystery around her identity. She'd been known as Horseshoe Harriet after her body was found 37 years ago near Horseshoe Lake, north of Anchorage. Troopers announced Friday the young woman's real name was Robin Pelkey, a 19-year-old originally from Colorado. Investigators identified her through extensive genealogy research. Troopers said Pelkey was living in Anchorage in the early 1980s, around the time Robert Hansen was picking up young women in the city, flying them to remote locations and murdering them. In 1984, Hansen pleaded guilty to 4 murders. He later admitted to killing a total of 17 women. From a helicopter, he showed investigators where he'd left the bodies. Troopers spokesman Austin McDaniel said Friday that Pelkey was one of the 17 women Hansen admitted murdering.
Alaska State Troopers were able to locate 12 bodies. At this point, now that we've identified Horseshoe Harriet as Robin Pelkey, there is one body that we've recovered that remains unidentified, and that is who we believe to be Robert Hansen's first victim, Eklutna Annie.
As they did in the Pelkey identification, McDaniel said the Troopers' Cold Case Investigation Unit continues to work with outside genealogical research labs on creating a DNA profile of Eklutna Annie and constructing a family tree to find potential family members. That technique has helped bring closure for previously unidentified murder victims in other cases, but McDaniel said it's also been used to track down suspects in at least 3 cold case murders in Alaska.
So that's major priority for the state troopers, for law enforcement in our state is not only to hold accountable those that victimize Alaskans, but also to bring closure to families of victims across the state.
McDaniel said he did not have any additional information about Pelkey's family or their reaction to hearing about her identification. He says they have requested privacy. Nicholas Begich III has filed federal paperwork to run for Alaska's sole U.S. House seat, the same seat once held by his grandfather, Congressman Nick Begich.
What I've been hearing from Alaskans is that they're ready to look forward into the future.
Also in the race, Congressman Don Young, the only person to represent Alaska and the U.S. House since Congressman Begich, disappeared on a charter flight to Juneau in 1972. Unlike his grandfather, the 44-year-old Begich is a Republican. He was a chairman of Congressman Young's campaign in 2020. Begich's campaign manager for his U.S. House run is Truman Reed, who was Young's campaign manager in 2020 and worked in his congressional office.
There's an eventuality here as well. I mean, at some point, you know, the congressman at 88 years old has served the state for nearly 50 years. And I think folks recognize that there's a limit to the amount of time left for him to do so.
Young's campaign did not respond to emailed questions. Young filed for re-election this summer and has nearly $500,000 in his campaign account. Begich is the executive chairman of a software development company and lives in Chugiak. Also in the 2022 race, Greg Brelsford, Shannon Scott Evans, and Randy Perham, all Republicans. The federal government has filed another draft environmental impact statement for a federal oil and gas lease sale in Cook Inlet and is asking for comments from the public. It's the second time in less than a year that the feds have put out an environmental review on a potential Cook Inlet sale since the Biden administration halted the process leading up to the auction earlier this year. That pause was part of a larger executive order aimed at fighting climate change. The leasing process resumed this summer when a Louisiana district court judge ordered programs to resume in Cook Inlet and the Gulf of Mexico following a lawsuit from Alaska and several other states. The states argued the Biden administration's decision was bad for economic development and that the feds bypassed the public process when they hit pause on the sales. The potential auction includes 224 blocks across 1 million acres in Cook Inlet from the southern end of Calgon Island down to Augustine Island. The department can still decide to cancel a lease sale after an environmental impact statement is filed. The Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, which oversees offshore leasing program, canceled sales in 2006, 2008, 2010 in Cook Inlet due to lack of industry interest. That is it for the KTOO News Update for Monday, October 25th, 2021. I'm Jeremy Shea. Thanks for listening.